Chapter 3. The scene in the gardens had impressed both mother and daughters almost with horror. Excited and alarmed, Lizaveta Prokofievna had literally almost run all the way home with her daughters. According to her notions and ideas, so much had happened, and so much had been brought to light by the incident, that certain ideas had taken definite shape in her brain, in spite of her confusion and alarm. But everyone realized that something peculiar had happened, and that perhaps, and fortunately too, some extraordinary secret was on the verge of being disclosed. In spite of all Prince S.'s former assurances and explanations, Yevgeny Pavlovich had been unmasked, exposed, detected, and publicly found out in his connection with that creature. So thought the mother and both her elder daughters. The only effect of that conclusion was to intensify the mystery. Though the girls were secretly somewhat indignant with their mother for her extreme alarm and too conspicuous flight, yet they did not venture to worry her with questions during the first shock of the disturbance. Moreover, something made them fancy that their sister Aglaya knew more of the matter than their mother and all of them put together. Prince S., too, looked black as night. He, too, seemed plunged in thought. Lizaveta Prokofievna did not say a word to him all the way home, and he did not seem to be aware of it. Adelaida made an attempt to ask him what uncle had been spoken of just now, and what had happened in Petersburg. But with a very sour face, he muttered something vague in reply about making inquiries, and its being all nonsense.
No doubt of that, assented Adelaida,
and she asked nothing more. Aglaya became exceptionally quiet, and only observed on the way that they were hurrying too fast. Once she turned round and caught sight of Mushkin, who was hastening after them. She smiled ironically at his efforts to overtake them, and did not look round at him again. At last, when they were nearly reaching their villa, they saw Ivan Fyodorovich, who had just arrived from Petersburg, coming to meet them. His first word was to ask after Yevgeny Pavlovich, but his wife walked by him wrathfully, without answering or even looking at him. From the faces of his daughters and Prince S., he guessed at once there was a storm brewing. But apart from this, there was an unusual uneasiness in his expression. He took Prince S.'s arm, stopped him at the entrance, and exchanged a few words with him, almost in a whisper. From the troubled air of both, as they walked afterwards onto the veranda and went up to Lizaveta Prokofievna's room, it might be surmised that they had heard some extraordinary news. By degrees they were all gathered in Lizaveta Prokofievna's room upstairs, and no one but Mushkin was left at last on the veranda. Though he had no conscious motive for staying, yet he sat on, in the corner, as though expecting something. It did not occur to him, as they seemed so upset, that he had better go away. He seemed oblivious of the whole universe, and ready to go on sitting for the next 2 years, wherever he might be put. From time to time, sounds of anxious conversation reached him from above. He could not have said how long he had been sitting there. It had grown late and was quite dark when Aglaya suddenly came out onto the veranda. She looked calm, though she was rather pale. Seeing Mushkin, whom she apparently had not expected to find sitting there in the corner, Aglaya smiled as though perplexed.
"What are you doing here?" she asked, going up to him.
Mushkin muttered something in confusion and jumped up from his seat, but Aglaya at once sat down beside him, and he sat down again. Suddenly she examined him attentively, then looked as though aimlessly at the window, and then again at him.
"Perhaps she wants to laugh at me," Mushkin thought. "No, she'd have laughed at me then." "Perhaps you'd like some tea. I'll order some," she said after a silence. "No, I don't know." "How do you mean, you don't know? Oh, by the way, listen. If someone challenged you to a duel, what would you do? I wanted to ask you before."
"Why? Who? No one will challenge me to a duel."
"But if they did, would you be very much frightened?"
"I think I should be very much afraid."
"You mean it? Then you are a coward?"
"No, perhaps not. A coward is a man who's afraid and runs away. If one's afraid and doesn't run away, one's not a coward," said Mushkin, smiling, after a moment's thought.
"And you wouldn't run away?" Perhaps I shouldn't run away. He laughed at last at Aglaia's questions.
Though I'm a woman, nothing would make me run away, she observed, almost offended.
But you're laughing at me and pretending, as you usually do, to make yourself more interesting.
Tell me, they fire at 12 paces, don't they? Sometimes at 10. So they must be killed or wounded.
People are not often killed at duels, I imagine.
Not often? Pushkin was killed.
And that may have been accidental.
It wasn't an accident. It was a duel to the death, and he was killed.
The bullet struck him so low down that no doubt Dantès aimed higher, at his head or at his chest. No one aims like that. So it's most likely that the bullet hit Pushkin by accident. People who understand told me so.
But a soldier I talked to once told me that they were ordered by the regulations to fire halfway up. That's their phrase, halfway up. So they're not ordered to fire at the head or the chest, but halfway up. I asked an officer afterwards, and he told me it was perfectly true.
Well, that's probably because they fire from a long distance.
But can you shoot?
I never have shot.
Don't you even know how to load a pistol?
No. That is, I know how it's done, but I've never done it myself.
Well, that means you don't know, for it wants practice. Listen and remember. First, you must buy some good gunpowder, not damp. They say it must not be damp, but very dry. Very fine powder. You must ask for that sort, not what's used in cannon. The bullets, I'm told, people make themselves somehow. Have you pistols?
No, and I don't want them, laughed Mushkin.
Oh, what nonsense. You must buy a good one, French or English. I'm told they're the best. Then take a thimbleful of powder, or two thimblefuls, perhaps, and sprinkle it in. Better put plenty. Ram it in with felt. They say that felt is necessary for some reason. You can get that out of some mattress, or doors are sometimes covered with felt. Then, when you've poked the felt in, put in the bullet. Do you hear? The bullet afterwards, the powder first, or it won't shoot.
Why are you laughing?
I want you to practice shooting every day, and to learn to hit a mark. Will you?
Mushkin laughed. Aglaia stamped her foot with vexation. The earnest air with which she carried on such a conversation somewhat surprised him. He rather felt that he must find out something, ask about something, something more serious anyway than the loading of a pistol. But everything had flown out of his head, except the one fact that she was sitting beside him and that he was looking at her, and it made no difference to him at that moment what she talked about. Ivan Fyodorovich himself came downstairs and onto the veranda at last. He was going out with a frowning, anxious, and resolute face.
"Ah, Lyov Nikolaevich, that's you. Where are you going now?"
he asked, though Mushkin showed no signs of moving.
"Come along. I've a word to say to you."
"Goodbye,"
said Aglaia, and held out her hand to Mushkin. It was rather dark on the veranda by now. He could not make out her face quite clearly. A minute later, when he had left the villa with the general, he suddenly flushed hotly and squeezed his right hand tightly. It appeared that Ivan Fyodorovich had to go the same way. In spite of the late hour, he was hurrying to discuss something with someone. But meanwhile, on the way, he began talking to Mushkin, quickly, excitedly, and somewhat incoherently, frequently mentioning Lizaveta Prokofievna. If Mushkin could have been more observant at that moment, he might perhaps have guessed that the general wanted to find out something from him, or rather wanted to ask him a plain question, but could not bring himself to the real point. Mushkin was so absent-minded that at first he heard nothing at all, and when the general stopped before him with some excited question, to his shame he was forced to confess that he had not understood a word. The general shrugged his shoulders.
"You're all such queer people, all about one," he began again. "I tell you that I am at a loss to understand the notions and alarms of Lizaveta Prokofievna. She's in hysterics, crying and declaring that we've been disgraced, shamed. Who? How? By whom? When and why? I confess I am to blame. I recognize it. I'm very much to blame. But the persecutions of this troublesome woman, who's misconducting herself into the bargain, can be restrained by the police at the worst, and I intend to see someone today and take steps. Everything could be done quietly, gently, kindly even, in a friendly way, and without a breath of scandal. I admit that many things may happen in the future, and that there's a great deal that's unexplained. There's an intrigue in it. But if they know nothing about it here, they can make no explanation there. If I've heard nothing, and you've heard nothing, he's heard nothing, and she's heard nothing. Who has heard? I should like to ask you. How is it to be explained, do you suppose, except that half of it is mirage, unreal, something like moonshine or some hallucination?
She is mad, muttered Mushkin, recalling with pain the recent scene.
Well, that's just what I say, if you're talking of her. That idea has occurred to me, too, when I slept peacefully. But now I see that their opinion is more correct, and I don't believe in madness. She's a nonsensical woman, I grant, but she's artful as well and far from mad. Her freak today about Kapitan Alexeyitch shows that too clearly. It's a fraudulent business, or at least a Jesuitical business, for objects of her own.
What Kapitan Alexeyitch?
Oh, mercy on us, Leof Nikolaevich, you don't listen. I began by telling you about Kapitan Alexeyitch. I was so upset that I'm all of a tremble still. That's what kept me so long in town today. Kapitan Alexeyitch Radomsky, Yevgeny Pavlovich's uncle.
Ah, cried Mushkin.
Shot himself at daybreak this morning at 7 o'clock. A highly respected old man, 70, a free liver. And it's just exactly as she said. A large sum of government money missing.
Where could she have...
Heard of it? Why, she had a whole regiment around her as soon as she arrived here. You know what sort of people visit her now and seek the honour of her acquaintance. She might naturally have heard it this morning from someone coming from town. For all Petersburg knows it by now, and half Pavlovsk, or perhaps the whole of it. But what a sly remark it was she made about the uniform, as it was repeated to me, about Yevgeny Pavlovich's having sent in his papers in the nick of time. What a fiendish hint. No, that doesn't smack of madness. I refuse to believe, of course, that Yevgeny Pavlovich could have known of the catastrophe beforehand. That is, that at 7 o'clock on a certain day, and so on. But he may have had a presentiment of it all. And I, and all of us, and Prince S., reckoned that he would leave him a fortune. It's awful. But understand me, I don't charge Yevgeny Pavlovich with anything, and I hasten to make that clear. But still, it's suspicious, I must say. Prince S. is tremendously struck by it. It's all fallen out so strangely.
But what is there suspicious about Yevgeny Pavlovich's conduct?
Nothing. He's behaved most honourably. I haven't suggested anything of the sort. His own property, I believe, is untouched. Lizaveta Prokofievna, of course, won't listen to anything. But what's worse, all this family upset, or rather, all this tittle-tattle, really one doesn't know what to call it. You're a friend of the family, in a real sense, Leof Nikolaevich. And would you believe it, it appears now, though it's not known for certain, that Yevgeny Pavlovich made Aglaya an offer a month ago, and that she refused him point-blank.
Impossible! Cried Mushkin warmly.
Why, do you know anything about it? You see, my dear fellow, cried the general, startled and surprised, stopping short as though petrified. I may have chattered on to you more than I should. But that's because you are such an exceptional fellow, one may say. Perhaps you know something?
I know nothing about Yevgeny Pavlovich, muttered Mushkin.
I don't either. As for me, my boy, they certainly want to see me dead and buried, and they won't consider how hard it is for a man, and that I can't stand it. I've just been through an awful scene. I speak to you as though you were my son. The worst of it is that Aglaya seems to be laughing at her mother. Her sisters told their mother, as a guess, and a pretty certain one, that she'd refused Yevgeny Pavlovich, and had a rather formal explanation with him a month ago. But she's such a wilful and whimsical creature, it's beyond words. Generosity and every brilliant quality of mind and heart she has. But capricious, mocking, in fact a little devil, and full of fancies too. She laughed at her mother to her face just now. At her sisters, too, and at Prince S. I don't count, of course, for she never does anything but laugh at me. But yet, you know, I love her. I love her laughing, even. Yet I believe she, little devil, loves me specially for it. That is more than anyone else, I believe. I'll bet anything she's made fun of you, too. I found her talking to you just now, after the storm upstairs. She was sitting with you, as though nothing had happened.
Mushkin flushed crimson, and squeezed his right hand, but said nothing.
"My dear good Leof Nikolaevich," the general began with warmth and feeling again, "I, and Lizaveta Prokofievna too, though she's begun to abuse you again, and me too, on your account, though I don't understand why, we love you. We love you truly and respect you in spite of everything. I mean of all appearances. But you'll admit yourself, my dear boy, that it is mystifying and irritating to hear that cold-blooded little devil suddenly, for she stood before her mother with a look of profound contempt for all our questions, mine especially, for confound it all, I was fool enough to take it into my head to make a show of sternness, seeing I'm the head of the family. Well, I made a fool of myself. That the cold-blooded little devil suddenly declared with a laugh that that mad woman, and that was her expression, and it strikes me as queer that she agrees with you, how can you have failed to see it till now, she says, has taken it into her head at all costs to marry me to Prince Leof Nikolaevich, and for that purpose to get Yevgeny Pavlovich turned out of our house. She simply said that. She gave no further explanation. She went on laughing, and we simply gaped at her. She slammed the door and went out. Then they told me of what passed between her and you this afternoon, and listen, dear Prince, you're a sensible man and not given to taking offence. I've observed that about you. But don't be angry. I'll be bound she's making fun of you. She laughs like a child, so don't be angry with her, but that's certainly it. Don't think anything of it. She's simply making a fool of you, and all of us, out of mischief. Well, goodbye. You know our feelings, our genuine feelings for you, don't you? They'll never change in any respect, but now I must go this way. Goodbye. I've not often been in such a tight hole, what's the expression, as I am now. A pretty summer holiday.
Left alone at the crossroads, Mushkin looked round him, rapidly crossed the road, went close up to the lighted window of a villa, unfolded the little piece of paper which he had held tight in his right hand all the time he had been talking to Ivan Fyodorovitch, and by a faint beam of light read,
"Tomorrow morning, at 7 o'clock, I will be on the green seat in the park waiting for you. I have made up my mind to talk to you about an exceedingly important matter which concerns you directly. P.S. I hope you will show no one this letter. Though I am ashamed to give you such a caution, I think that you deserve it, and I write it, blushing with shame at your absurd character. P.P.S. I mean the green seat I pointed out to you this morning. You ought to be ashamed that I should have to write this, too."
The letter had been scribbled in haste, and folded anyhow, most likely just before Aglaia came out onto the veranda. In indescribable agitation, that was almost like terror, Mushkin held the paper clenched tightly in his right hand again, and hastily leapt away from the window, from the light, like a frightened thief. But in doing so, he ran full tilt into a gentleman who was standing just behind his back.
"I've been following you, Prince," said the gentleman.
"Is that you, Keller?" cried Mushkin, surprised.
"I was looking for you, Prince. I've been watching for you by the Epanchins. Of course I couldn't go in. I walked behind you while you were with the General. I'm at your service, Prince. You may dispose of me. I'm ready for any sacrifice, even death if need be."
"Oh? What for?"
"Why, no doubt a challenge will follow. That Lieutenant, I know him, though not personally. He won't accept an affront. The likes of us, that is, Rogozhin and me, he's inclined to look upon as dirt, and perhaps deservedly. So you are the only one called upon. You'll have to pay the piper, Prince. He's been inquiring about you, I hear, and no doubt a friend of his will call on you tomorrow, or he may be waiting for you now. If you do me the honour to choose me for your second, I'm ready to be degraded to the ranks for you. That's why I've been looking for you, Prince."
"So you're talking of a duel, too?" laughed Mushkin,
to Keller's great surprise. He laughed heartily. Keller, who had been on tenterhooks until he had satisfied himself by offering to be Mushkin's second, was almost offended at the sight of the prince's light-hearted mirth.
"But you seized him by the arms this afternoon, Prince. Well, that's hard for a man of honour to put up with in a public place."
"And he gave me a push in the chest!" cried Mushkin, laughing. "There's nothing for us to fight about. I'll beg his pardon, that's all. But if we must fight, we will. Let him shoot. I should like it. I know how to load a pistol now. Do you know I've been taught how to load a pistol? Can you load a pistol, Keller? First you have to buy powder, pistol powder, not damp, and not as coarse as for cannon. Then you have to put the powder in first and get some felt off a door. And then you have to put the bullet in afterwards, and not the bullet before the powder, or it won't go off. Do you hear, Keller? Or else it won't go off. Isn't that a magnificent reason, friend Keller? Ach, Keller, do you know I must hug you and give you a kiss this minute? How was it that you turned up so suddenly this afternoon? Come and see me sometime soon and have some champagne. We'll all get drunk. Do you know I've 12 bottles of champagne at home in Lebediev's cellar? They came into his hands somehow, and he sold them to me the day before yesterday. The very day after I moved into his house, I bought them all. I'll get the whole party together. Are you going to sleep tonight?
As I do every night, Prince.
Well, pleasant dreams, then.
Mushkin crossed the road and vanished into the park, leaving Keller somewhat perplexed. He had never yet seen Mushkin in such a strange mood, and could not have imagined him like this.
Fever, perhaps, for he's a nervous man, and all this has affected him. But yet he won't be frightened. I'm sure that sort are not cowards, by Jove,
Keller was thinking to himself.
Champagne. An interesting fact, though. 12 bottles, a dozen, a decent provision. I'll bet that Lebediev got that champagne as a pledge from someone. He's rather nice, that prince. I like such fellows. There's no time to lose, though, and if there's champagne, it's the moment for it.
That Mushkin was almost in a fever was, of course, a correct surmise. He wandered a long while about the dark park, and at last found himself walking along an avenue. The impression was left on his consciousness of having walked 30 or 40 times up and down that avenue, from the seat to a tall and conspicuous old tree, a distance of 100 paces. He could not, if he had tried, have remembered what he had been thinking all that time, which must have been at least an hour. He caught himself, however, thinking one thought which made him burst out laughing. Though there was nothing to laugh at, he kept wanting to laugh. It occurred to him that the suggestion of a duel might have arisen not only in Keller's mind, and that therefore the conversation about the loading of pistols was not without motive. Bah! He stopped suddenly. Another idea dawned upon him.
She came out onto the veranda just now when I was sitting there in the corner, and was awfully surprised to find me there. And how she laughed! She talked about tea, and she had that note in her hands all the while, of course. So she must have known I was sitting on the veranda. Why, then, was she surprised?
He took the letter out of his pocket and kissed it, but at once stopped short and pondered.
How strange it is! How strange it is,
he said a minute later, even with a certain sadness. In moments of intense joy, he always grew sad. He could not himself have said why. He looked round attentively, and was surprised that he had come there. He was very tired. He went to the seat and sat down on it. There was an extraordinary stillness all round. The music in the gardens had ceased. There was perhaps no one left in the park. It must have been at least 11:30. It was a soft, warm, clear night, a Petersburg night in early June. But in the thick, shady avenue where he was sitting, it was almost dark. If anyone had told him at that moment that he had fallen in love, that he was passionately in love, he would have rejected the idea with surprise and perhaps with indignation. And if anyone had added that Aglaé's letter was a love letter, arranging a tryst with a lover, he would have been hotly ashamed of such a man, and would perhaps have challenged him to a duel. All this was perfectly sincere, and he never once doubted it, or admitted the slightest double thought of a possibility of the girl's loving him, or even of his loving her. He would have been ashamed of such an idea. The possibility of love for him, for such a man as he was, he would have looked upon as a monstrous thing. He fancied that, if it really meant anything, it was only mischief on her part. But he was quite unconcerned by that consideration, and thought it all in the natural order of things. He was occupied and absorbed with something quite different. He fully believed the statement, dropped by the excited general, that she was making fun of everyone, and of him, Mushkin, particularly. He did not feel in the least insulted at this. To his thinking, it was quite as it should be. To him, the chief thing was that tomorrow he would see her again early in the morning, would sit beside her on the green seat, would learn how to load a pistol, and would look at her. He wanted nothing more. It did once or twice occur to him to wonder what she meant to say to him, and what was this important matter which concerned him so directly. Moreover, he never had a moment's doubt of the real existence of that important matter for which he was summoned. But he was far from considering that important matter now. He did not feel, indeed, the slightest inclination to think about it. The crunch of slow footsteps on the sand of the avenue made him raise his head. A man whose face was difficult to distinguish in the dark came up to the seat and sat down beside him. Mushkin turned quickly, almost touching him, and discerned the pale face of Rogojin.
"I knew you were wandering about here somewhere." "I haven't been long finding you," Rogojin muttered through his teeth.
It was the first time they had seen each other since their meeting in the corridor of the hotel. Amazed at Rogojin's sudden appearance, Mushkin could not for some time collect his thoughts, and an agonizing sensation rose up again in his heart. Rogojin saw the effect he had produced, but although he was at first taken aback and talked with an air of studied ease, Mushkin fancied soon that there was nothing studied about him, nor even any special embarrassment. If there were any awkwardness in his gestures and words, it was only on the surface. The man could not change at heart.
"How did you find me here?" asked Mushkin, in order to say something.
"I heard from Keller. I was going to see you." "He's gone into the park," he said. "Well," thought I, "so that's how it is."
"What is?"
Mushkin anxiously caught up the phrase he had dropped. Rogojin laughed, but gave no explanation.
"I got your letter, Leov Nikolaevich. It's all of no use, and I wonder at you. But now I've come to you from her. She bade me bring you without fail. She's very anxious to say something to you. She wanted to see you today."
"I'll go tomorrow. I'm going home directly. Are you coming to me?"
"Why should I? I've said all I had to say. Goodbye."
"Won't you come?"
Mushkin asked gently.
"You're a strange fellow, Leov Nikolaevich. One can't help wondering at you."
Rogojin laughed malignantly.
"Why so? Why are you so bitter against me now?"
asked Mushkin sadly and warmly.
"You know yourself now that all you thought was untrue, but yet I fancy that you are still angry with me. And do you know why? You're still angry because you attacked me. I tell you, I only remember that Parfion Rogojin with whom I exchanged crosses that day. I wrote to you last night to forget all that madness and not to speak of it again. Why do you turn away from me? Why do you hide your hand? I tell you, I look upon all that happened then simply as madness. I understand what you were feeling that day, as though it were myself. What you fancied did not exist and could not exist. Why should there be anger between us?"
"As though you could feel anger,"
Rogojin laughed again, in response to Mushkin's sudden and heated speech. He had moved two steps away, and was actually standing with his face averted from Mushkin and his hands hidden behind him.
"It's not the thing for me to come and see you now, Leov Nikolaevich," he added slowly and sententiously in conclusion.
"You still hate me so?"
"I don't like you, Leov Nikolaevich. So why should I come and see you?" "Oh, Prince, you're like a child. You want a plaything, and you must have it at once, but you don't understand things. You're saying just what you wrote in your letter. Do you suppose I don't believe you? I believe every word.
You never have deceived me, and never will in the future. But I don't like you all the same. You wrote that you've forgotten everything, and you only remember the brother Rogojin, with whom you exchanged crosses, and not that Rogojin who raised his knife against you. But how do you know my feelings?"
Rogojin smiled again.
"Why, perhaps I've never once repented of it, while you've already sent me your brotherly forgiveness. Perhaps I was already thinking of something else that evening. But about that..."
"You had forgotten to think," Mushkin put in. "I should think so. I bet that you went straight then to the train and flew off here to Pavlovsk, to the bandstand, to follow her about in the crowd and watch her as you did today. That doesn't surprise me. If you hadn't been in such a state at that time that you could think of nothing else, perhaps you wouldn't have attacked me with the knife. I had a presentiment from the first, looking at you. Do you know what you were like then? When we changed crosses, that idea may have been already at the back of my mind. Why did you take me to your mother then? Did you think to put a check on yourself by that? That, no, you cannot have thought of it, but you felt it just as I did. We were feeling just the same. If you had not made that attack, which God averted, what should I have been then? I did suspect you of it. Our sin was the same, in fact. Yes, don't frown. And why do you laugh? You've not repented. Perhaps even if you wanted to, you couldn't regret it, because you don't like me besides. And if I were like an innocent angel to you, you'd still detest me so long as you think she loves me and not you. That must be jealousy. But I thought something about that this week, Parfion, and I'll tell it you. Do you know that she may love you now, more than anyone, and in such a way that the more she torments you, the more she loves you? She won't tell you so, but you must know how to see it. When all's said and done, why else is she going to marry you? Some day she will tell you so herself. Some women want to be loved like that, and that's just her character. And your love and your character must impress her. Do you know that a woman is capable of torturing a man with her cruelty and mockery without the faintest twinge of conscience, because she'll think every time she looks at you, I'm tormenting him to death now, but I'll make up for it with my love later?
Rogojin laughed as he listened to Mushkin. But I say, Prince, have you come in for the same treatment? I've heard something of the sort about you, if it's true.
What?
What could you have heard?
Mushkin started and stopped in extreme confusion. Rogojin went on laughing. He had listened with curiosity, and perhaps with some pleasure, to Mushkin, whose joyful and impulsive warmth had greatly impressed and encouraged him.
And I've not merely heard it. I see now it's true, he added. But if you talk like this before, I never heard you say such things before. If I hadn't heard something of the sort about you, I shouldn't have come here. To a park, too, and at midnight.
I don't understand you at all, Parfion Semyonich.
She told me about it a long time ago, and I saw it for myself today as you sat listening to the band this afternoon with the young lady. She's been vowing, she's swore to me today and yesterday, that you were head over ears in love with Aglaya Epanchin. Well, that's nothing to me, Prince, and it's no business of mine. If you have left off loving her, she still loves you. You know that she's set on marrying you to her. She has sworn to do it. She says to me, tell them I won't marry you without that. When they've gone to church, we'll go to church. I can't make out what it means, and I never have understood. She either loves you beyond all reckoning, or, if she does love you, why does she want to marry you to someone else? She says, I want to see him happy, so she must love you.
I've told you and written to you that she's out of her mind, said Mushkin, who had listened to Rogojin with distress.
Well, the Lord knows. You may be mistaken, but today she fixed the wedding day when I brought her home from the gardens. In 3 weeks' time, or perhaps sooner, she said, we will certainly be married. She swore it and kissed the icon. It all rests with you now, it seems, Prince.
That's all madness.
What you've said about me will never be. I'll come and see you tomorrow. How can you call her mad? Observed Rogojin. How is it she seems sane to everyone else and only mad to you? How could she write letters to her? If she had been mad, they'd have noticed it in her letters.
What letters? Asked Mushkin in alarm.
Why, to her, to the young lady. And she reads them, don't you know? Well, then, you'll find out. Of course, she'll show them herself.
I can't believe that, cried Mushkin.
"'Ugh, Lyov Nikolaevich, you've only gone a little way along that path, as far as I can see. You're only beginning. Wait a bit. You'll keep your own detectives yet and be on the watch day and night too, and know of every step she takes, if only—' "'Stop, and never speak of that again!' cried Mushkin. "'Listen, Parfen, just before you appeared I came here and suddenly began laughing. I don't know what about. The only reason was that I remembered it was my birthday tomorrow. It seems to have come on purpose.' It's almost 12 o'clock. Come, let us meet the day. I've got some wine. Let's drink some. Wish for me what I don't know how to wish for myself. You wish it, and I'll wish all happiness to you. If not, give back the cross. You didn't send the cross back to me next day. You've got it on now, haven't you?
Yes, said Rogojin.
Well then, come along.
I don't want to meet my new life without you, for my new life has begun.
You don't know, Parfen, that my new life has begun today.
I see for myself now, and know that it has begun, and I'll tell her so. You're not like yourself at all, Lyov Nikolaevich.